It is the death of a human being, and I think that's a profound thing. It should be a profound thing. And it's being represented as a simple menu choice, and I think that's vile.
Coming up on British Thought Leaders, Kevin Yule talks about assisted suicide and euthanasia. Labour leader Sir Keir Starmer says he's in favour of changing the law, but Kevin is confident things won't go that far.
The more you look at this issue, the more you need to think again, the more you need to reconsider any kind of legality for assisting a suicide and for euthanasia.
He says legislating for death leads to a dystopian future.
Nobody wants to be able to help everybody commit suicide. It's always divided into two different groups in society. It's always those whose suicides we will strenuously try to prevent, and those whose suicides we actually approve of and even assist.
Welcome to British Thought Leaders, I'm Lee Hall. Today I'm sitting down with Kevin Yule, Emeritus Professor of History at University of Sunderland and CEO of Humanists Against Assisted Suicide and Euthanasia. Kevin, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I was hoping we could start with you giving us an overview of the legal situation of assisted suicide and euthanasia in the UK.
Well, it was prohibited. Assisted suicide was prohibited under the 1961 Suicide Act. And there is a maximum of 14 years that somebody can get for assisting a suicide. And the proposals are to change that law that are coming up, that have come up in the past and are coming up right now in Scotland. There's a bill in Scotland that's intending to change the law. And there will be, we're fairly certain, bills coming up in the next parliament once Keir Starmer, Keir Starmer becomes Prime Minister.
Keir Starmer said he's personally in favour of changing the law. Do you feel it's almost inevitable that we're going to see some change in Britain?
No. I'm very positive about this because I think the more you look at this issue, the more you need to think again, the more you need to reconsider any kind of legality for assisting a suicide and for euthanasia. And what we've noticed is, for instance, in Scotland, I've just had a colleague do some work on the numbers, that in fact, people, as they see these terrible stories from Canada, from Belgium, from the Netherlands, where it's been legal for some time, then I think people are changing their mind. In Scotland, it's really on a knife edge. And what I've noticed from the polls is that since 2019, people are on a trajectory away from assisted suicide, from legalizing assisted suicide. I should explain, if you'll allow me, that I use assisted suicide because I think there are various different facets of this question which confuse people. So a lot of people talk about assisted dying, and I think that is a fairly Orwellian and marketing term, and I don't use it, and I criticize people for using it because I think it masks what's really happening. What is really proposed in this country is assisted suicide, whereby the person, the patient, I suppose, ingests deadly drugs in order to kill themselves. And what is euthanasia? Euthanasia is when the doctor delivers the deadly drugs through a lethal injection. And I think it's very necessary for us to be honest in how this is debated right from the very start, in order to have any kind of perspective on the issue.
So as an assisted dying, you're kind of just helping someone along, whereas actually you're helping them commit suicide.
Well, this is it. It's suicide or homicide, and people are very frightened to say this. And I think we need to actually think through what is really being proposed here. And it is the death of a human being. And I think that's a profound thing. It should be a profound thing. And it's being represented as a simple menu choice. And I think that's vile.
We saw the front page of The Economist recently. They said assisted dying, the term they used, will be the next great social reform in Britain. In Financial Times, it's similarly supportive. ITV even filmed a conversation between Keir Starmer and Esther Ranson, who's a campaigner that expressed her own wish to have assisted suicide. I mean, do you think the public can make an informed, unbiased view when the media is kind of weighing quite heavily on one side?
It very much is. I think if we had honest debate in the country, then I think people will actually take, you know, they'll realize what is being discussed. But I think that's one part of the problems I have with the language, is that it's preventing people from thinking deeply about what is really happening. And that is Orwellian in a terrible sense. So I think, I mean, The Economist has had me write for them before about this issue, so I won't criticize them too much. But the elephant in the room in all of this is utility, and I find it slightly ironic that two financially oriented papers are suggesting this on the basis of freedom. There's no freedom argument about this either. You know, first of all, people have the freedom to kill themselves, to end their lives, either in an active sense as in suicide or in a passive sense as in refusing food and drink. And those are important freedoms and we need to have those, and I would fight for those freedoms. I think it's important. But what you don't have freedom to do is get somebody to push you off a ledge, which is essentially what assisted suicide is. Mm. It's getting somebody to validate your perspective. As an atheist, I find it very troubling that, in fact, after we've kicked priests out from the bedside, we're having doctors perform that same rite. There's no need for a doctor to do this. So to kill a person is not a complex act, even for what they are proposing. You need to be able to find a vein, and there are many people who can do that. It's not necessary, but people really want that sort of medical assurance, you know, that medicine is validating their suicidal ideation, I suppose. And I think that's one of the real problems I have with this. But yes, to return to The Economist and FT, they have these spurious arguments on the basis of freedom, when in fact, if they were to follow the logical conclusions, they would also have to support dueling, which is, of course, you know, if it's two private individuals contracting with each other, and you know, they would have to do that. They would also have to taking it to its logical conclusion, consensual cannibalism, if you remember back to that revolting story coming out of Germany a few years ago. Why, if you were in favor of freedom of people doing such, making a contract between each other, like what they are pushing it forward, like they're posing that question, then why wouldn't you be in favor of all contractual freedoms like that? And that's, I think, the irony. Nobody's really in favor of freedom. Nobody wants to be able to help everybody commit suicide. It's always divided into two different groups in society. It's always those whose suicides we will strenuously try to prevent, and those whose suicides we actually approve of and even assist. And you can never have a total freedom, because otherwise it would be anarchy. We would have to validate every suicidal wish. So there's always this government control on the whole thing in the first place. So the freedom argument, I would argue, is very spurious and doesn't stand up to reason.
You mentioned someone on a ledge. I mean, it would always be considered, if someone's standing on a ledge and they're going to jump, the right thing to do would be to try and talk to them and persuade them not to do so. But this movement is basically putting forward the argument that, well, they want to jump, so the right thing to do would be help them.
Well, precisely, and this is a point that I've made for many years, is that the proverbial man teetering on the bridge, and I use man because it's generally men who do commit suicide more often than do women, but there's the proverbial man teetering on the bridge, and we should talk him down. That is, as a community, that is what we're there for. That's what our role is as people who are fellow citizens with this particular troubled man. It could be that he has very legitimate reasons for doing so, but we have to make the assumption that we will save a life. I think it's a virtuous act to save a life, and you to talk somebody down, you are saving a life, and it's just as virtuous, even if he goes the next day and successfully suicides, then I still think it's a virtuous act to save that life. And I think that's one of the things that legalizing assisted suicide and euthanasia will threaten, is this contract that we have between each other to protect people sometimes from themselves. but most often from others. And I think, you know, that's reflected in homicide laws. It's reflected in suicide laws in that we don't weigh up whether somebody is elderly and therefore encourage their suicide. It's just as wicked to kill an 84-year-old who doesn't like their life as it is to kill a 24-year-old who has their life in front of them. We don't make this distinction here, but we will be introducing this distinction if we legalize assisted suicide and or euthanasia in this country, just as it's been done elsewhere. You have the two different, very unequal groups in society in relation to whether we prevent their suicides or encourage them.
If someone is in intense pain, they make a decision and it won't necessarily be in their best interests or in the best interests of their families. I mean, are there safeguards in place that could ensure those decisions are, or is it just a risk that this direction will take?
It's very difficult to really be certain about it. Part of the problem, which has come up in a very interesting case in Canada, where a 28-year-old woman who lived with her parents, autistic, but as far as her father knows, no other medical conditions, has been granted euthanasia against the wishes of her father. And her father sued to try and find out, well, on what basis is this euthanasia being granted? But of course, because they're medical records, they're private. Right. And this is one of the real problems of making it part of medicine, is that it's private. So in Quebec, they've just released a report whereby out of all the deaths last year, there are 19 of them that they don't know why they actually occurred. And nobody's has recorded this.
So you know, like assisted suicides, 19
the
of them.
Euthanasias, because where both are legal, it tends to be euthanasia. So in Canada, there were only a handful of cases amongst the 30,000 deaths that occurred, which were actually self-delivered, so to speak, whereas the vast majority are euthanasia, where both are legal. So yes, in the 19 of these cases, if we heard about 19 wrongful executions, we would be very concerned. That would make the news. And yet there's no chief witness, there's nobody to even hold to account over this. This is what's very frightening. There's nobody to hold to account over the decision to destroy this man's daughter. He can't even know, he can know who the doctors are, but they don't have to justify their decisions because it's a clinical decision.
Can we go into some more detail on what's happening in the countries that have gone down this route? Can you give us some examples?
I've just given you this example from Canada. It's a Kafkaesque nightmare whereby you can't know who is in charge, who is making these decisions, and you can't hold them accountable for it. So there are problems there. But there have also been other cases coming out of Canada, which one is, of course, a gentleman who was being made homeless, and therefore he was granted euthanasia. He did have other reasons, physical reasons, why he was granted it. And he... But he made the point that this is his problems would be solved if he actually had a house. So, but he, I believe in the end, was able to crowdfund some accommodation, thank goodness. But there are many cases. There are people in Canada, there are cases, there was a film made by a commercial company in Canada that was celebrated the death of this one particular woman. It was like an advertisement for euthanasia. Mm-hmm. And she had been in the press under a pseudonym complaining about the fact that she could get no pain relief. So she took her life. Well, she had her life taken from her because she couldn't access decent medical care. Mm-hmm. So there are all sorts of issues there. In Belgium, there's some pretty horrible cases of, for instance, twins who are losing their sight, and on that basis they were granted euthanasia. It's a very good piece in the New York Review of Books about a gentleman who came home to an email that said, can you collect your mother's things because she has been granted euthanasia. Mm-hmm. His mother had been facing mental health problems for a very long time. He knew that, but the people who gave her the lethal injection didn't seem to care enough about that, and he took it to court. He did. He had a partial victory against that. But it was just shocking that a woman who's mentally disturbed and whose family knew this, of course, because it's a medical issue, it's entirely private, and he couldn't even know about it. It was her decision. So there are a number of cases like that. There are 8 cases in the Netherlands of people whose only reason for, who were physically healthy, but they were autistic. And they were granted euthanasia because they were autistic. Mm-hmm. And they couldn't cope with the situation, with changes of the situation. One whose parents were elderly, and the parents were fearful of what would happen, and he was granted euthanasia rather than to live his life. So to me, there are social problems that we need to come to grip with, and death is being used as this catch-all solution in these countries where it's available. Mm. And I think that's a real problem.
Does it tend to be a progression for a country that's granted assisted suicide and euthanasia for terminal illness that they then later grant it for medical or social reasons?
Well, yes, and it makes sense. If you grant it to somebody as relief for unbearable suffering, which is included in all of the legislation in Canada, Belgium, the Netherlands, then how can you deny it to, for instance, a child who's unbearably suffering? How can you deny it to anybody who's unbearably suffering? And of course, what happens is as soon as it's granted for some, for people who have 6 months to live, that's the proposal in this country, obviously somebody with 12 months to live is saying, well, I'm going to suffer longer than that person with 6 months to live. Why shouldn't I have it? And the courts tend to open these things up. In Canada, it was legalized in 2016 for people whose death was, quote, reasonably foreseeable. By 2020, they removed that from the legislation, that phrase reasonably foreseeable, to allow it for people who had conditions as well as terminal illnesses. And now they have just put off, but they will, they're determined to put through euthanasia on the basis of mental health suffering, which is what is legal in the Netherlands. I'm writing about a case right at the moment of a woman called Yolanda Fun, who is 33 years old, and she said, I find it dark and gloomy and depressing. And she has managed to convince 2 psychiatrists to okay her euthanasia. Her parents, of course, are beside themselves, but can't do anything. You know, it's this terrible situation. So yes, we will go down that track if we legalize assisted suicide in this country. There is no question.
If people are given assisted suicide and euthanasia for other reasons, medical, etc., do we get to the point where we don't really value each life as much as another? Like, oh, this life is worth protecting more than this life because this person has some kind of mental health issue. It's almost like a euthanasia movement.
Well, it is, and this is the great secret with this whole movement, which began in 1870 with Samuel Williams, who presented to the Birmingham Speculative Club this idea of euthanasia. And he made the point that people are suffering unnecessarily, but they're no longer good to anybody else. So it's always had this twin idea of compassion, but also utility. And this was taken much further in the early 1900s in the United States, whereby they called for chloroforming of the infants of poor people.
Really?
Yes. I've got chapter and verse on this in an article I've written. They said for people who suffer from alcoholism, for people who have suffered from disease, for the blind, for various different groups of people. And they made no bones about it. It was euthanasia for the good of the state. And this was, ironically, just to skate back to Canada these days, there is a proposal for euthanasia for alcoholics that has come from one of the chief alcohol, he's a doctor who specializes in alcoholism. Mm. And drug addicts and alcoholics, it's been floated as an idea. So we're returning really to the past. But then it was talked about simply as euthanasia. It's only in the late 1920s and 30s when it became a movement to change public opinion that they put they tagged on the voluntary bit. Before that, nobody really made much of voluntary euthanasia. It was much more consent they would talk about rather than the person actually wanting it themselves. They would be convinced into it. So that happened. And then, of course, because of the horrors of the Second World War, whereby more than 70,000 disabled people were dispatched in gas chambers, which of course happened before Jews were actually moved into the gas chambers. This is they experimented on these people who are generally from mental hospitals. They wanted to empty them out. And so they had a euthanasia program in the Third Reich. But that program had actually started before the Third Reich. It was in the 1920s. There was a interesting pamphlet. Sorry, I'm a historian, so I will.
That's great.
I will.
Please do.
I will carry on as long as you let me. But in 1920, there's a pamphlet that talked about termination of lives that are useless, I believe. I'm getting the title wrong. It's written in German. And it was basically saying people in mental hospitals, they use up a lot of resources. All of these various different groups, they were particularly keen on what was called the black stork, which is to get rid of infants who were destined to be disabled. And why should we have, you know, look how much money we can save over an entire lifetime by eradicating these people. It was called negative eugenics. It was very much connected with the whole idea of eugenics. And it was called negative eugenics to cut the people who are a drag on resources. And what's been very interesting recently, I don't know whether you're familiar with the Matthew Paris article in the Times. Matthew Paris floated this idea as well. He said, look, we have to have assisted dying because we have a very long list of people who need operations and we are using up too many resources on people at the end of life or people who are very, very disabled.
So save the NHS.
Exactly. Save the NHS. Kill these people is the very blunt aspect of it. And there's always been that utility behind it. And it's only now that it's sort of coming out. There's also a Canadian report put out by, I believe, the Treasury, whereby they estimated how much money they could save if they had euthanasia as they have it right now, or if you moved on to what's their Bill C-7, which is to legalize it for people with mental health conditions but physically healthy. And they estimated that there was 86.2 million that have been saved. They wildly underestimated the numbers who were taking this up. It's risen in Canada every year, this year by 34%, I believe. And so they underestimated how much savings they could make. But basically, it came out to around $16,000 per person under the existing situation. And if you include people with mental health difficulties, it goes up to $54,000 per person. So there are real savings to be made, but they want to keep this quiet because, of course, whilst you are campaigning for people to support this act, then you have to keep quiet about the utility argument because people tend to get upset when they think that you are wanting to eradicate their relatives or even themselves because they're a drag on the economy.
Seems horrifically dystopian, this idea of, you know, life having a monetary value and get rid of them.
Yeah, I mean, it is that dystopia. And as I say, the mask is falling at the moment, both in this country and elsewhere. This is one of the reasons I'm very positive about the future and that we can defeat this bill that I think is inevitably going to come in the British Parliament and in the Scottish Parliament. I think we're very, very close to defeating it. You might have seen that Nicola Sturgeon has come out and against it. Homes of Youssef is against it. So there's every possibility of defeating it. I think people just have to think a little bit harder about the whole issue, and I think they will come to that realization. Hannah Arendt makes this great point of banality of evil, that people, she defined evil as just not thinking enough. And I think of that when I think of the term assisted dying, because it just, it covers up, it makes it into a lovely choice that people can make, very comfortable, very comforting. It's all good. It's all something that people should want to have. And yet it covers up what is really happening, which is some sort of killing, either suicide or homicide. And I think we need to think again about this, and that's why I think I'm pretty positive about the future.
The head of Belgium's biggest health fund talked about euthanasia to deal with an aging population. It's almost like we're at the ultimate kind of stage there, where it's not, no one, these people don't have a problem, they're just going through life and getting old. Yeah, I was blown away that someone could be in the media talking about that, but it seems to be accepted quite normally.
Well, and this is, he repeated the point that Matthew Paris made, but he made it as the head of a health insurance organization, which you kind of think they must be having these discussions behind closed doors anyway. And I think this is, as I say, the mask has fallen somewhat, and that's exposed the real agenda of assisted suicide and euthanasia. It is resources-based in the end. And I think, I hope that people will realize that and then turn away from it, because it's one of those issues that if I just came to you in the street and said, do you think dying people should suffer at the end of life? I mean, nobody's going to say, yeah, I think that. No, everybody's going to say no. Well, do you think maybe that they should be granted this last wish of assisted dying? It's always posed in those kind of terms. And of course, when it comes to the reality of the situation, it's nothing like that. It's a complete cover-up. One thing, I would never, I'm friendly with my opponents, so I would not want to impugn their reasons for doing it. And I say this as a caveat before what I'm about to say, but of course, during the Third Reich, one of the things that they tried to do was to advertise and say they had weighing scales with a family of five on one side and a mentally ill person on the other side, making the point that the money that it takes keeping this mentally ill person alive could feed a family of five. And this would, of course, help the state, as they were very keen to do then. And they failed at that campaign. There was a Catholic bishop called Bishop Galen who attacked them and said, woe betide us if we start killing off our old. What happens to the soldiers that come back who have served the Reich? And because they're now disabled, we're going to dispatch them. And he made this excellent argument, and Hitler backed down one of the very few times and discontinued the program officially, though unofficially he carried it on. But one of the most interesting things is that there was a film that they funded. It was funded directly by Joseph Goebbels. And it was removing the utility idea, and it put it into a context of a woman who was terminally ill with, I think she had multiple sclerosis. And it was this great propaganda film, which is still, for me, the greatest propaganda film for assisted dying ever made. I don't like some of the newer upstarts, but this one, which is called Ich klage, I can't do the German pronunciation, Ich klage an, which means I accuse, took place where a husband killed his wife at her request because she was dying of multiple sclerosis and she was going downhill. He was a doctor, he knew how to do it, but a love rival who exposed him, and he was taken to trial. And it's the whole discussion at the trial. And finally, the love rival says, I think you loved her more than I did by killing her. And nothing is mentioned about savings, nothing is mentioned about anything other than this poor woman. And you suddenly realize they must have clicked, this is the way to propagandize for this movement.
Could you just talk us through the different organizations that are in this space?
Yet Dignity in Dying is perhaps the largest group of proponents of a change in the 1961 Suicide Act. And they have, as far as I can see, millions of pounds. They have a very slick advertising campaign. They have offices on Oxford Street. They were funded by Terry Pratchett, who is one of the famous people who is very much a proponent of assisted suicide, of legalizing assisted suicide. And then there are also Humanists UK, who are, despite the fact that I'm a humanist, don't believe that there's any other way of thinking about this than to support assisted suicide and euthanasia. They support both, and they also support it beyond the 6 months to live. So they would legalize it for a condition, right, for instance, that somebody's suffering with. They very much are similar to the Canadian style. And they're very active on, for instance, Jersey, where it's being talked about at the minute, and in Scotland. And so there are those that are the proponents, and whereas those opposed would be Living and Dying Well, which is an organization that is made up of the hospice movement. Hospice doctors oppose it at a rate higher than anybody else in society, which you might think about why that is. And it's because they see thousands and thousands of people dying, and they know the reality of it. They know it's not necessary, and they worry about the implications. It's being forced. Hospices are being closed in British Columbia, for instance, because they refuse to have it on their doorstep. And they are funded by the Catholic Church. The Catholic Church is very opposed to any change in the law.
So that told you either go along with this or you shut down.
Yeah, and that's and there were horrendous cases. There was another one where somebody snuck into a Catholic hospice and killed somebody on the premises in Canada. Yes, and of course nobody, because the person had agreed and wanted it, this person just snuck in without telling anybody about it.
So were they prosecuted?
No, because it was. I believe they were prosecuted. They might have been prosecuted, but they weren't. They certainly weren't, it wasn't successful prosecution. So, in fact, successful prosecutions, I should add, are very, very rare. Even the 1961 Suicide Act, there have been, between 2009 and 2021, there were four successful prosecutions under the Assisted Suicide Act. It's what I like to think of as a law that has a stern face but a kind heart. I actually agree with Keir Starmer's current situation. He set it up as Director of Public Prosecutions, whereby you only prosecutions in the public interest take place. So he's instructed the police not to prosecute these cases unless they feel there are real reasons. I think that works quite well. I think we need to be a little bit, you know, there are cases where there are genuine mercy killings that may be necessary. I would never say never. I'm not opposed to these individual situations. I just think the law should continue to apply, and it should be legally wrong to kill somebody. That's my particular idea on this. But yes, just to go back to the organizations, that's what we were talking about, wasn't it? There's Not Dead Yet, who is opposed to it, which is an organization of disabled people who can see that the resources argument is going to come at them in the end. They cost the most resources in society, and they see a civilized society as one who treats people equally, no matter how much resources they use. And I think that is a very essential idea of civilization, that you don't get rid of your elderly, you don't get rid of your disabled. It's how we treat those people that I think determines how civilized we are in many ways. There's Not Dead Yet. There's also, as I said, Living and Dying Well. And there are numerous religious organizations. And often the whole discussion is wrongly characterized as religious people versus progressive humanists. And so therefore that's my niche, I suppose, is as an atheist who opposes it for the same reasons that the Christians do. This is the thing, they are forever taking the ball and not taking the man, so to speak, in that the proponents of assisted suicide say, oh, it's just a few religious bigots who are preventing us from this progressive legislation. And of course, it's not. And there are many people who are in favor, who are opposed to changing the law, who are not religious at all. And but very few of us speak out, so that's what I'm trying to do at the minute.
Kevin Yule, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.